ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh. Tom Linney will join us next time on ACT.
Here at ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals,
how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also talk about how eating a plant-based diet is the best thing you can do for yourself and for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, or if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stick around for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Seth Tibbett, who's the inventor of tofurkey. That's coming up a little later on ACT, but first some news.
UT San Diego reports on a smuggler who owes $3 million for fish bladders. To the untrained eye, the delivery of coolers that Jason Jin Shin Chi picked up at Calexico would seem innocuous. In shipping the goods on their way to China, prosecutors say he listed the boxes as containing dried fish. Not exactly a lie. The contents, in fact, were Tuaba fish bladders, a highly prized commodity in China for its purported medical properties that have contributed to the fish's critically endangered status in its native Mexican waters. The black market for the fish trade is a lucrative one, with a single dried bladder fetching $5,000 to $10,000, and prosecutors say Xi cashed in. Now the U.S. wants Xi to pay the Mexican government $3 million in restitution. That puts the value of each of the 270 fish that he admitted to smuggling at over $11,000 apiece. Xi, who lives in Sacramento, was sentenced in San Diego federal court on October 25th to 4 months in prison. And the upcoming fight for restitution shows the U.S. wants to send a strong message to fish traffickers. According to U.S. Attorney Melanie Pearson, this crime is more than just an economic crime. It is also an attack on an endangered species because the smuggling of the fish bladders is a growing problem along the border, and we need to send a strong message to others. At least six other people were charged with fish bladder smuggling this year in a seemingly unrelated case, all out of Calexico, with about 7,000 pounds of fish bladder seized at the border. In one of those cases, a man was detained with 27 bladders at the border. Agents followed him to a house in Calexico that appeared to be set up as a bladder factory where fish were dried and packaged. Another 214 bladders were seized there. Commercial fishing for the Tuaba goes back more than 100 years. The fish, the largest in the family that includes sea bass and combina, can grow up to 6.5 feet in length, and they only reproduce once a year. They're found only in the Sea of Cortez, and each year spawn up the Colorado River Delta, making them especially easy target for anglers. The sun-dried bladders, which are high in collagen, are believed to boost fertility and improve the skin, and are the key ingredient in a centuries-old Chinese soup recipe. Even in the early 1900s, the bladders commanded a high selling price, selling for about $5 a pound. The fish's meat was discarded as trash, left to rot on the banks. Americans discovered the fish in the 1920s, and a market for its meat grew, and the bladders being removed and sold to China. And by 1946, the U.S. was exporting about 2.8 million pounds of fish bladder. The Tuaba population never rebounded, and it is protected under the Endangered Species Act, as well as an international trade pact that includes the U.S. and Mexico.
Last time on ACT, I reported on arsenic in chicken feed and how it's passed on to humans in chicken meat. Turkeys are also fed arsenic to promote fast growth and to kill parasites. A new study published in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives reveals that despite the voluntary withdrawal by the pharmaceutical company Pfizer of its arsenic drug Roxarsone back in 2011, chickens and turkeys are continuing to be fed arsenic. Back in 2011, the Food and Drug Administration published the results of a study they did revealing that poultry meat contained high levels of arsenic. After this study was published, little was done in the way of actually regulating Roxarsone. The FDA did nothing about the findings. But word got out about Roxarsone, and Pfizer quickly and vocally pulled the drug off the market, leading the public to believe that chicken and turkey were now safe. But no. According to researchers from Johns Hopkins University in Maryland, another arsenic-containing drug known as nitarsone is quietly being fed to chickens and turkeys. The Center for Food Safety, along with nearly a dozen other advocacy groups, has filed a lawsuit against the FDA for failing to protect the public by banning both antibiotics and arsenic in poultry feed. Later this month, I'll be thankful to be celebrating with a meal of arsenic-free tofurkey. And speaking of tofurkey, coming up next on ACT Radio, we feature a conversation with the founder and CEO of Turtle Island Foods and the creator of tofurkey, Sith Tibbet. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is Seth Tibbet. Thanks for being with us, Seth.
Hey, Seth. Can we start out by having you tell our listeners how you got into a vegetarian, vegan lifestyle?
Sure. I turned vegetarian in 1973, and it was in college in Ohio. And I was a naturalist at the time, and I read Francis Moore LePage's Diet for a Small Planet, as I believe Greg did.
Yeah, that started me, too, back in 78.
And it just made a lot of sense to me that, you know, running all these grains through animals, which were basically a protein machine in reverse, you know, you dumped 12 or 16 pounds of grain into the top of this machine, if you will, metaphor, and then ended up with a pound of, you know, protein. It just didn't make any sense, and it seemed very wasteful from a natural resource standpoint, you know, with far-reaching impacts on how land is used. And I was, you know, a wildlife guy, and you'd see, you know, the pressure on these, especially in Ohio, on the farmlands and farm country were just spreading out all over and encroaching on wildlife habitat. And so I was thinking, wow, you know, if we were just eating grains directly, there'd be a whole lot more land for wildlife habitat, and that was my main thing. And, you know, it was a pretty terrible diet that I fell into. I mean, I did have some lentils and rice and some good stuff from the cookbook section of Diet for a Small Planet, but it was like, I call that diet the vanilla wafer vegetarian which was really a lot of, you know, it was technically, well, you weren't eating meat, but you weren't eating that great. But, you know, then I sort of progressed from there and started following the teachings of Stephen Gaskin and The Farm, which is a group in Tennessee that was a intentional community, and it was all vegan food that they ate. They had 1,000 people living on like 1,600 acres, and they grew all these soybeans, and they were processing soybeans. They actually did a lot of the initial research in and popularization of soy foods, you know, tofu, tempeh, soy milk, that they were all, and soy ice cream too, making down the farm. So through reading that literature and their cookbooks, I started eating a much better diet, and it was mostly soybean based, you know, and I was experimenting around with different soybeans because my mother, who was raised in the Depression in Minnesota, was like, where in the world are you going to get your protein? You're going to die, you know, if you don't eat meat. And I was like, no, I'm okay, Mom, I'm eating soybeans. So I would make soy grit burgers and different things, and it was through Stephen Gaskin's farm that I learned about tempeh, which I had at the farm when I visited in like 1976, and it was just a wonderful food, and it was love at first bite, and that's where I got started on the tempeh path.
Yeah, I remember back in the 70s, the only hamburgers and hot dogs you could eat came in a can from Loma Linda.
Oh, yeah. Loma Linda, actually, I don't know if that brand is still around,
I know
that a lot of it turned into Morningstar, which, of course,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Big brand of meat alternatives.
Which sold out to Kellogg's, I believe.
Exactly. So here it goes from Loma Linda into Kellogg's.
But you're not going to sell out Tofurky, are you?
I haven't, and I don't have any plans to. You know, we've been a family-owned, independent company the whole time, and that's kind of like one of the unique things about Tofurky Company is that, you know, we've never taken any equity investment. It's always been just like bit by bit, you know, reinvesting the profits back into the company and, you know, being poor for a lot of years because of that. But it was an intentional choice. And, you know, we've also had bank loans and, you know, things that we've paid back. But it's never really been a money play. You know, it wasn't initially. That wasn't the reason for starting to make tempeh commercially in 1980. It was really just to do good and have a right livelihood sort of business. And then, you know, it sort of grew from there. And now it's great because my stepson, Jamie Athos, is in the business, and he's 39, and he is just a brilliant guy. He's a neuroscience PhD major in neuroscience from University of Washington. And he's been working here 7 years now, and, you know, he's just the sharpest. He is the sharpest knife in the drawer.
Yeah, that's
he's
great.
Done a lot of the project management on this new lead platinum plant that we're opening up next year. And
let's talk about that.
Before we talk about that, tell us a little bit about how you came up with the name Tofurky.
Yeah, and how that all got started.
Yeah, because it's as you know, it's a funny name. People love saying Tofurky.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Tofurky was a name that you can actually see reference to as far back as like the 1970s. And, you know, I first, I think, heard it maybe sometime right around 1980 when I was now, you know, after making tempeh that I learned how to make from those first batches of tempeh eaten on the farm in Tennessee. You know, I opened the doors to it was Turtle Island Soy Dairy is what I called it then, in 1980, and we were making tempeh back then. And, you know, I made three kinds of tempeh, soy, five grain, and this spicy sausage temperoni product. That so we had three different kinds. And, you know, I just kept making tempeh because I loved it, but it was a very niche-y market. It's still kind of a niche market, tempeh.
Yeah.
Although it's growing at leaps and bounds right now. But, you know, back in 1980, it was very, very niche-y. And I was like, you know, living the dream but losing my shirt. And, yeah, cottage industry level and not profitable at all. And so we were always experimenting with different. You know, we had tempeh burgers and different tempeh strains, you know, with making it with wild rice or whatever, sesame, garlic, you know, and these flavors. But still, it was, you know, we couldn't break out of this niche, and we were selling through the Northwest and West Coast tempeh only for the first 15 years. And I was living on about $300 a month, you know, for those 15 years, and lived in a treehouse and trailer and teepee and all these little, you know, wherever I could find a home that would fit my budget. But I was always struggling, you know, at Thanksgiving to find something to eat because, you know, I noticed that vegetarians, and I was no different, were sort of either backsliding into turkey or they were, you know, forgetting their sort of healthy diets during the holidays, or they were making these concoctions that took all day to make, and you know, it turned out okay or great or not good, but it was a lot of work. So I was always looking for something, you know, to have at the holiday table, and just personally to eat that was sort of bomb-proof and, you know, good and festive and would sit proudly next to a turkey if you were at a gathering where there was that being served or if you were at a vegetarian gathering. So in 1995, I was working with Hans Robel from the Higher Taste, who's a caterer friend of mine in Portland, and he was making these, he called them holiday stuffed loaves in his kitchen and selling them for $50 to like 25 of his customers at the holidays. And I was like, wow, you know, maybe we can do something. So I added the tempeh drumettes, these 8 drumettes, to this big pile of tofu and gravy. And then we packaged it as tofurkey, and that became, you know, very popular. We sold 500 of those that first year, and, you know, that's where we got our start.
And it had 8 drumsticks. I guess the thought of marketing it as a tofu spider never occurred to you.
That never did, but that's a good point. You know, we didn't know what they looked like in the wild, but we knew they had 8 limbs of some sort and these tofurkeys. And that was, you know, a good point, because when we were first dreaming this up, we were thinking like, oh, it's Thanksgiving, you know, and at that point, I mean, I was eating... most of my friends were vegetarian at that time, and so I was thinking, yeah, these will just go into a big vegetarian feast. There'll be all these vegetarians sitting around eating this. And then, so this tofurkey had a price tag of about $30, $35. It was like 3 or 4 pounds, and there were a few of those big vegan or vegetarian gatherings, but the more common problem we learned after that first year was one or two vegetarians going to grandma's house or whatever and, you know, not having anything to eat. And, you know, they just wanted to bring a smaller portion. So we reduced the size of it in coming years and sort of honed it over 3 or 4 years until we came up with the current recipe.
And then, of course, it has doesn't have, like, wish bones in there. And
yeah, we added wish sticks because we wanted, you know, to bring the sort of the magic and the celebration of, you know, because the turkey has all of these, you know, symbols and sort of fun things that people do. I mean, it's a sort of concept in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Apart this animal, but we were like, let's find a compassionate, you know, way that doesn't involve that to still make wishes, because hey, wishes are important, dreams are important, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
And then along came your product line, which I understand took off even better than the holiday roast.
Well, it took off. The holiday roast, yeah, was a big success, and it, you know, took us out of the niche market of the Northwest and West Coast, and you know, there were stores clamoring for this everywhere because we got a lot of TV coverage, and you know, because nobody thought like there'd be anybody crazy enough to make a product like this, you know, in the mainstream media. So they jumped all over it, and we were on all these TV shows and everything. But then so we had 2 or 3 holiday seasons where we'd make tempeh all year, and then tofurkey would just be in the fall, and it was fun and good. But you know, at January 1, the phone stopped ringing, and it was just, you know, back to sort of survival mode again. So we were trying to build on that success, and, you know, that's when we looked at, well, what does the turkey industry do? Well, they have deli slices and sausage and stuff, so we came out with deli slices, and they became a big hit, and then sausage, and they became a big hit, and so...
And now you've got today, some new products. You've got pies and pizza. And...
Right. So we've expanded even more now into the freezer set with these pot pies and pizza, and those are going well. But the, you know, core items now are still the deli slices and sausage, of which we're the biggest producer of refrigerated meatless deli slices and sausages on the planet, actually. So
they're always in my fridge.
Oh, great. And, you know, they've been a good product for us. We just came out with 3 new artisan sausages.
What are those?
Spinach pesto andouille and chicken apple. And I was just down in New Orleans a couple weeks ago at a produce show selling the andouille, is what they call it down there. It's a spicy Cajun sausage.
That
was very well received there.
When, how about here in the Southwest, we have another kind of sausage that another marketer makes called soy riso, which is a knockoff on chorizo, which I think would be a great next artisan line for your company because it does have a really nice spice mix.
That's great. Yeah, I think I've had that. And actually, we do have a tofurkey chorizo.
Oh, you do?
We have it now. It's not in the form of a sausage. It's like a ground product.
Oh, yeah. Really?
But that's been very popular.
I don't think we
popular.
Have it here, do we?
No, we've got the sausages, the pizza, and the deli slices.
And the tofurkeys, of course, for Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So there is tofurkey chorizo, but, yeah, that's been very popular, you know, as the sort of Southwest cuisine spreads throughout North America.
Well, I'm going to have to ask our local store to start carrying that.
Yeah. I'd like some of the pockets, the stuffed pockets. They're tasty. I had them at a conference, but haven't seen them here yet.
Yeah, it's a long haul. You know, when I first started marketing products, the natural food industry was in its infancy, and, you know, it was really, you'd bring your products to the stores in Portland, these first three tempeh products, and they were like, oh, this is awesome. Do you have any more products? Like, now we can fill up our shelves with something. And literally, it was just, like, very easy to get placement. And, you know, I guess the tribute to the success of natural foods is that it is now a very competitive market, and, you know, we're going up against the biggest corporations in the world, who, like Kellogg's and people like that, who really have a lot of muscle in controlling, you know, freezer shelf space and refrigerated shelf space. So
I didn't even realize that was, like, competitive until recently when I went to our local Sprouts store, and I asked them why they weren't carrying things, and they're like, well, you know, the person that sells at the company, they have to pay for the freezer space. I didn't realize it was done that way.
Yeah, the freezer category is about three times the size of the refrigerated category, and so it has a lot more players in the game, and it is usually pay to play, you know, where you kind of pay an upfront fee, which can be anything from, you know, a couple $1,000 or a free case for every store up to as high as like $100,000 per item for, and that guarantees that your product will be in there for 1 year or 6 months or something.
Wow.
It's just like
crazy. No wonder you need a PhD in neuroscience to navigate the marketing system. Boy, that's tough.
You need a banker or something too. And, you know, I mean, those big numbers, of course, you know, we are not in our budget, but, you know, what happens is the hotter your product is, the less you have to pay, you know, because the more track record you have, if you can go into these places and say, hey, look, this tearing it up in these natural food stores, so Mr. Or Ms., you know, grocer, look at, if you bring these in, they're going to do the same thing here. So how about if I just give you a free case of all of these for the store? And it doesn't always work, but, you know, you negotiate from there. And so, but that's how the grocery industry works, and especially in the freezer. Although we've had good luck down there in Texas with HEB, we just became the largest soy product company in HEB, and are working with that chain to fan out over Texas. And, you know, they have some good accounts. They're a good account for us, too.
Yeah. We've only got a couple of minutes left, and I did want to mention your new plant. LEED stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. And your plant that's opening next year, or early next year, is the second such plant in the country?
Actually, right now, there's another one that opens, so it'll be the third when it opens next year, and about and the sixth in the world. And it's usually like it's like Coke and ConAgra and some of these other big companies that have achieved this. It's very difficult for a food processing plant to achieve, but there again, hats off to, you know, my stepson, Jamie, who has gone through all the documentation and lead and made this happen. So, yeah, we're really excited to, you know, be making the product in a sustainable green plant. And this is, you know, incredible. It's got 400 solar panels on the roof and free electric car charging stations. And we made all the, like, cabinets and desks out of old pallets that we laminated together, you know, the beat-up pallets. And they look great. And we pulled logs out of the Columbia River to make tables. And
wow.
It's pretty cool.
So you're staying true to your mission of trying to lessen your impact on the environment as your company grows.
That's the idea, Liz. Yeah, you know, we're trying to make a natural product in a natural fashion. You know, although, you know, I do go back to my roots because I feel like the most sustainable aspect of our company will always be the fact that we're trying to make a meat alternative, you know, because meat is just the most unsustainable, you know, you take process that you could ever invent to make food, you know, for people's sake, you know, not even talking about the cruelty and ethical and moral aspects of it, but just from a purely sustainability aspect, it is not sustainable. And as the, you know how hard it is on the ecosystems now, and you imagine when the population grows and doubles, like, what is it going to be? And something's got to give here. And so we're just excited to be, you know, a small little part of this massive change that I think society is going to inevitably be going through.
We've been talking with Seth Tippett, the inventor and founder of Tofurky and Turtle Island Foods. We really appreciate what you brought to all of us vegetarians and vegans in your product lines. And tell our listeners where they can go on the web to learn more about your products.
Yeah, sure. It's tofurky.com, and that's T-O-F-U-R-K-Y.com. No E in Tofurky, although if you do throw an E in, that'll get you there, too.
Oh, yeah.
And where you can learn about our products, and also we're having a couple of Tofurky trots this year. We do every Thanksgiving. We're doing one in Portland, Oregon, and one out there in the Rose Bowl in Los Angeles. So that'll be Thanksgiving morning.
And oh, neat.
They're a lot of fun, raising some money for some good sanctuaries.
Oh, that's wonderful, Seth. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you, Seth.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving. Uh-huh. Happy Tofurky Day.
As you're shopping for food for the holiday coming up, you might consider Tofurky. It's available at Sprouts, Cielo Vista Natural Market, and Mountain View Market in Las Cruces. And it doesn't have any arsenic, and it doesn't have any fecal contamination, and it's mighty tasty.
And if you need additional recipes, you could check out the ACT Radio website at ktep.org and look for some of our past cookbook authors that we've interviewed and check out their cookbooks for delicious holiday recipes.
And if you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, please visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso at vsep.org. Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Liz Walsh for the Animals, the Earth, and a Healthier Humanity. Thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.